Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Joshua Behrman. Josh is Epic's co-founder and CCO and has written for Wired, GQ, the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and is a regular contributor to This American Life. Josh has written about meteorite hunters, deranged private investigators, jewel thieves, surfing smugglers, and the metaphysical implications of being the world's greatest Pac-Man player. He was a finalist in the 2004 National Magazine Awards, and his work has been anthologized in various Best American series. The movie Argo was adapted from Behrman's 2007 Wired article, The Great Escape. Hey, Josh, it's great to have you on the Cool Tools Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, and it's so great to have a Wired writer on the other end of the line. I really appreciate your work you've done in Wired over all these years.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, I'm excited that Wired is still a place where you can publish 10,000 words about a meteorite in Peru.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And yeah, that's something that Wired's been doing since it started in 1993.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Pieces like that, which is cool. No small part from Kevin's editing.
Well, yeah, go long when the rest of the culture is going short.
Yeah.
Exactly. Big when they zag.
Exactly.
There we go.
Yeah. That was in the writer's guidelines.
Yeah.
So you have some tools to talk about. Tell us about this email scheduler.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is called Adios. I assume that's how it's pronounced because it's the word adios with, a period somewhere in the middle with some weird domain to make it look like adios. And this was discovered actually by my assistant. This is going to sound like sort of like ridiculously organized I suffer from, the tyranny of the inbox like everyone else. And I've tried all these various systems to, manage it, right? I'm going to achieve, be an inbox zero person, which I did achieve once. Like I saw it. It was like
for 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was like getting a glimpse of the absolute, like Moses after God walks by and sees the afterlife, and then it was gone, and then that sort of was paradoxical because it was like satisfying to know that there was not much email in my inbox at any given time. However, it required this like constant maintenance. And then I created a new email address that's just for this or that or whatever. So I was kind of wondering aloud with my assistant sitting around one day, I wonder if there's a way to get I'm a little bit basic in my technology. So I'm using the Mac mail client. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, I wonder if there's a way to set it so that it just only sends you email every so often so that you basically unwire your neurological pathways to seek, the constant influx. Because I feel like just over time, your brain gets rewired to be looking for a certain kind of stimulus, and then that sort of affects concentration, and also it identifies a certain constant input mm-hmm. into this machine that you're sitting at. And I'm a writer, so I'm trying to get out of that. So I was like, maybe I'll just do that. And then he went and just found this service that this is the Adios that you can log in, use it. You can log into it with your you can log it into your Gmail accounts and then specify times, and you can do as many as you want. I chose one. I tried two, and then it was working so well that I moved it to one. So then it just, you don't have any email until the appointed time, and then it all shows up, and the effect is very quickly. It's really interesting. Within, for real, 48 hours, you just forget that there's email coming at you all day. And so the quality of mind sort of returns. And then all the email shows up at once. And then you just dispatch it, in 15, 20 minutes and deal with everything. And that's it. And also by then, half of those emails are just threads that are all like, by the time you're seeing them, everything's been resolved anyhow. And so it has become the very effective sort of like concentration tool.
Wow. So the big question is, what time do you get your email?
Well, I was doing it when I had two times. It was, let's see, what was it? It was noon and six. So then I left the morning free, right? And then at noon, okay, I'll check in, see like what's what. And then 6 o'clock is the end of the day, catch up on things, a little bit of time to sort of see what happened and deal with it if necessary. Then I went to just six, mostly because I'm in production on something right now. So like, I don't really have time in the middle of the day anyhow. But that worked really well. Actually, it was those two times, sort of midday and end of the day. And again, like I said, it's like the end of the day, a lot of the stuff that is going back and forth is sort of essentially resolved itself. It's like Churchill apparently used to open his mail 3 weeks later on purpose because he said that by that time 90% of it will be resolved and the really important stuff will still be important. So I've kind of like created a digital right. Churchill.
Are you thinking about maybe doing it once a week now?
I don't actually know. It's a good question. I don't know if you can set it that way. I do have to kind of, it's like once a day is pretty good. And every so often there's a little bit of a problem because this is sort of on my main inbox where if I send out things to people like, hey, let's meet for lunch on Tuesday, they're responding and then wondering what's happened to me.
Why don't you just have a disclosure at the bottom or saying telling people that you only read mail once a day at 6 p.m.?
Oh, yeah, maybe I could do that. Well, so I used to have a bounce on my email that was, this was another of my efforts. That was like, I'm on sabbatical, so I may never get back to you. But then that just drove people crazy. And I wasn't really on sabbatical, actually.
you could be more truthful and say, look, I read my mail at 6 p.m. You'll hear from me then, if you hear from me. And it may actually spread the goodness. The habit around. Absolutely. What if everybody in the world only emailed at 6 p.m.? They didn't even send it until 6. That would be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it should be implemented worldwide and make everybody. Yeah,
right. So what happens if you have you're writing a story for Wired and your editor has a quick, urgent question for you because it's like already in layout? And they're on press check or something,
Yeah. So every so often there's some emergency. But then the thing is people figure out some other way, In my case, I have an assistant, so you can always email the assistant. Mm-hmm. Or if it's somebody like on my staff or something, then they'll text me or call me.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that works. Yeah. So adios will time shift or batch mode, put your mail into batch mode, and you find that allows you to concentrate, and therefore you're more, the main thing, it may not reduce the amount of time you spend replying, but it certainly liberates the rest of the day so you're not distracted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. It reduces the direction. I think it also does limit the time because it's sort of the constant trickle accumulates a sort of you kind of switch between apps, you go over there, you half write an email and then finish it later. And it's sort of like the time ripples throughout the day when you're answering email all day. And then it's sort of when it's all together, you move through it faster.
Okay. That's worth trying.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got another one. It's a app to identify flowers. Or an app? Is it an app or is it something else?
It's an app. Yeah, it's called iNaturalist, I think. And I got into this because I was on a residence, like an artist residency, which is where my first email sabbatical experiment arose. And it was out in the woods, and it was sort of late summer, and there were wildflowers everywhere. And I was like, "What are these flowers?" And I kind of always fancied myself as the type of person who like knows, sort of like arbor culture and, like horticulture and can pick out, you know, Queen Anne's lace from across the meadow or something, which now I can thanks to iNaturalist because you just, you know, you use the camera, you go up and take a picture, and then you get the petals sort of a flower. I think maybe even leaves too, but I've only done flowers. And it comes, and then it searches basically a database, and some, you know, it was probably using some kind of machine learning algorithm to recognize this in relation to all the other flowers. And then it gives you a suggestion, says, is this, I think it's probably this. And for the most part, it's correct. Sometimes it'll give you one and you're like, that's a different flower. And then you can save it and then you share it basically into the database. It kind of adds, you can see, that shows you actually all the incidences of that flower around the country that through the app. And so you're sort of adding to the database every time you're taking pictures.
Wow. And so in your own experience, how successful is it? What's its success rate in terms of course, you're not the expert. You don't know whether it's true or not, but how often does it with confidence give you an answer?
Pretty often. I mean, probably 80%. There were really only a couple times where I had to look super closely and then look at sort of for external sources, you know, like just look up on the web, like what does, you know, such and such marigold look like, and then look at the petals up close and make sure it's the right one. But for the most part, it was pretty good.
And does it ever do something which like a human taxonomist would do, which is you give it something and it says, well, you know, I need a bit of more information. Look at the stem or take a picture of the stem.
Oh, right.
And
no,
because that would be the sort of next step.
Yeah. Right. No, that would be a good idea. Right. You just like take a picture of the stem or the like leaves at the base.
Right.
Or
whatever. So, it says, well, this is a tricky one. Show me the underside of the leaves or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, that's not happening. It's just a single image.
Yeah, exactly. It's a single image and a single input. And that could be iNaturalist 2.0, potentially.
Okay. But and it's just flowers? Because it was my – I don't have that, but it was my feeling that it did things
– Might also do trees based on leaves and stuff, but I haven't tried it for that, although that's entirely possible.
Okay.
I think it was because of I happened to be kind of in the woods at a time of flowering. And so everywhere I turned, which is all these different flowers. So if it had been in the fall, maybe I would have been identifying the, you know, magisterial, you know, changing colors of the oaks or whatever. But it's really satisfying because now I know certain, you know, like, oh, there goes a, you know, forsythia, and there's daffodils, and there's you know, like looking now at other flowers, I mean, oh, here's some verbena.
Yeah, it sounds really, really cool. I'm gonna have to try it out. And it's, I guess it's probably iPhone and Android,
presumably.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, it also it's kind amazing. Of nice because it makes you stop and, you know, like not smell the roses, but you kind of, or you might admire them for a second and then keep going. You sort of like, ooh, let me stop. I'm going to take a look. You kind of have to look closely at the petals. Yeah. You know, it sort of requires a little bit more detailed engagement.
Yeah, I like that.
Cool.
You have to notice things around you more.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that actually maybe identifying maybe even insects and birds. But
I'm looking at it right now, on the, and it does look like it has birds and insects. Which is, that's exciting. Now I'm going to use bird. I also want to be able to, you know, say, oh, there's the red-throated warbler. The birds, I think, are harder, though. Like, how would you get the picture? I don't know. We'll have to find out.
Well, anyway, it sounds very powerful. So thanks for that tip. So you have it's like an analog writing device.
Yeah. So this is a Japanese felt, I think it's a felt tip pen. Or it's sort of the modern version of a felt tip pen, but it's not a ballpoint. And it's got a very narrow tip or nib or whatever it's called. And stylus, I don't know. And this came about because I started sort of related to my avoidance of email, keeping a written journal. Got a bunch of notebooks. I'm going to, you know, write down my thoughts. What's that going to be like? Which I've never done even as a kid. And so I experimented with a lot of writing. Also, I have really bad handwriting, like crazy chicken scratch. So certain types of tips accentuate that, and certain ones make it a little bit more legible. So these pens, I don't remember where I found them, but they're these kind of Japanese, very kind of fine pointed, very nice, sophisticated little pens. And they also have, they're refillable. You can get these, you can sort of like, they're a little bit like a fountain pen where you can change the, like a modern fountain pen, not with a bladder, but with a little cartridge. And so you can swap them out. And they're pink. At least the ones I have are pink, although I didn't really realize that because I'm slightly colorblind. So everybody's like, I love your pink pen. I was like, really? I thought this was tan. no idea. I was like, sort of doing a performatively like adolescent girly thing, like writing in my journal with a pink pen, you know, like sitting at a coffee shop, which is what I was doing every morning. So the Zig pen is, you know, it's just a great little writing device.
They do make some Japanese pens, make some pens where they have a kind of the tip is slightly flexible, almost like a stiff brush. Or is this nib of this a much stiffer?
It's stiffer. It's stiffer. I do actually have one of those also. I found that's another pen that I like, although it somewhat encourages me to be sloppier because it's like the brushes, the fact that it's playful means you kind of do more playful movements. And then I'm like, I can't read this. But I do have some of those. I forget what they are actually. I have them here, but this one is pretty stiff. And I think my particular, what is it? Graphology requires a stiffer tip.
Yeah. There are, on Amazon, it's Kure Take Zig Pen, Koryo Body.
Yeah.
So I think Kure Take looks like it's the make. Great.
I
yeah.
Buy you know, the little packs of them, and I order them on Amazon.
Okay. So Josh, your fourth one, tell us about ground bags.
Oh yeah. So this is ground. Is sort of just one of the many, 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 many companies nowadays making like leather doodads and bags, right? There's sort of a proliferation of these where it's like toiletry kits and a tech, you know, place for all your cords and a little clasp for your iPhone, you know, headphones and all that stuff.
So it's called This Is Ground.
This is Ground.
That's the brand. Okay.
Yeah, that's the brand. Don't know why it's called that. Not sure what it means. But it's sort of like pretty well made. Like it's not the best ones you'll see. It's not like walking into one of like some fancy leather store where you're like, ooh, this was like made in Italy and the stitching's all perfect. Like it's nice. Also, it's very soft. The leather's soft. So it's not sort of like a hard case type of thing. And I have a bunch of the DOP kits where I just, you know, when I'm traveling, actually what I do is I have one that sort of just has everything in it, like doubles of all of my cords and stuff, and is just sitting there like in my bag always so that I don't have to remember to take it. So it's like sort of like a tech DOP kit with all the cords ready to go. I also have a little, like a briefcase, but that's for my iPad Pro, and it's got inside all these little slots for like the stylus and like, you know, your notebook and all these little things. There's a very, I'm a, depending on what you believe the clinical definition of OCD to be, I'm sort of probably, you know, a couple of notches.
You're on the spectrum.
Yeah, I'm a couple of notches outside of the official kind of like spectrum threshold for OCD of certain types of things. And like organizing my stuff is where that type of behavior is. And so I like really like, you know, things that have pockets where everything goes in its place. And the This Is Ground bags are those types of bags where there's all these little, it's kind of like the Wall-Aul, remember, you know, like the 60s, 70s plastic, like kind of like classic of modern design, where it's like this plastic thing on the wall that has all these little pockets that you put all your stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, you know, it's got that type of, organizational, it's not quite that expansive, it's not as big, but it's got that organizational instinct. And so So that's why I like those.
And they must feel very nice because they're made out of leather versus like plastic or cloth.
Yeah, yeah. And it's soft leather, so it's sort of satisfying to their touch. Like it's a nice leather. Uh-huh. And it also doesn't look in a way, it's like looks really nice, but doesn't look too fancy. Like if you had sort of like a harder, shinier leather, it'd look like you're sort of, you know, like carrying your attaché through Milan, you know, like en route to some fashion show or something. So it's not quite, it's like nice, but not super fancy.
And so you have like a laptop bag and a briefcase as well by the same folks.
Yeah. Well, I have the little cord kits and then the iPad little briefcase. It's like it's the size of the iPad Pro. Interest. This is sort of semi-related, but irreproducible. But my actual laptop bag is made custom for me by my girlfriend, who is leather designs accessories, and it's sort of based on looking at those and just like designed for my actual stuff. So that's like satisfying some super ultimate like organizational mania. But there's only one of them. Otherwise, I would be recommending it as well.
Sounds nice.
Yeah, sounds really great. So yeah, those. I'm two notches below you because I use, you know, cheap Amazon see-through clear plastic these things that you know, I have, you know, the cords in one thing, I've got the, you know, USB drivey adapters in another, and also they're nested, right? So you can put the small ones into the bigger ones, and
right. I kind of like that. I like that idea.
Yeah, yeah. So, and having dupes of everything, having a second set always in my bag is a huge step forward for me, because, you know, I travel a lot, so I'm always ready to go, and I don't have to search around for things. They're just there.
Yeah, it's like your technological 60-second bag. If you're like Robert De Niro in Heat, and you just need to walk away from the job in 60 seconds, and you're thinking about it, it's like the cord carrying equivalent of that. Because it's the same where I'm just like, I don't really want to pack it, and I've done it where I've like, I forgot my bag, and now I don't have any of my cords, and I got to go buy some. And so it was the same. Like once I got that, and it's funny because it's such an easy, obvious thing to do, but for some reason there's kind of an inertia, like a psychological inertia around buying two like cords for your computer. You're like, well, I only need one, but it's not that big of an investment, and it just like makes things so much easier.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I have a separate charger. I have the whole duplicated thing. Battery chargers. Everything is duplicated from my desk, my office, and then my travel bag.
Oh, I love it. I like this. Yeah. I like the idea of the see through. That would be really good, also, just for like your stuff for traveling, because then you sort of can see at a glance, like, okay, I have it.
Wait, I tell you something else weird, which I don't understand, which is the TSA. Like if it's inside your bag and they see it with an X-ray, it's like, that's a no-no. If you take it out of your bag into another bag, that's a see-through bag. It's like, that's okay. Even if the X-ray sees the same thing, but somehow the fact that it's in it. So that's the other reason why I have, you know, my batteries for my cameras and stuff. They're in another bag. And so it's like, they're going to see the same thing, the same view, but they like to have a clear, and you can move it off. You're taking it out of the bag, which doesn't really make any sense. But that's the other thing that I do, is all the things that might be like, you know, your batteries, your cell phones are all in one, where all the batteries are. So they like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's occurring to me now, I get stopped at the X-ray, not infrequently. I think because when you have a lot of like electronic-y things or cords. Yeah,
I just show them. I put them in the plastic things and show and just take them all out. So that's the other thing is, like, of course, I have TSA pre, so these days I don't have to do that. But when you don't have TSA pre, I just take everything out of my bags and lay my bags out. And it's like, and then yeah. they're happy.
Yeah.
That's true. So Josh, unfortunately we kind of have bumped up against the time limit, but I just wanted to let people know that you wrote a story in Wired that was published a couple of months ago, I think, you co-wrote with Allison Keeley about meteorite hunters in Peru. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of typical of your like really great epic adventure stories where you do a lot of traveling and interview people and go on the scenes and stuff. It's a great article. Has this one been optioned for a movie?
Thank you so much. It was. It's not the most obvious movie you ever heard. I mean, it would be in like a former time mm-hmm. nowadays, like because there's no actual aliens or monsters, but they were so compelled by just kind of the adventure story and the basic true mystery of, you know, mm-hmm. rocks from space. And what does that represent in terms of like the mystery of the cosmos? And, so I really enjoyed working on that story, and I was thrilled that Wired published basically all of it. I mean, I always write way long and then I'm prepared for it to be cut. But my last two stories in Wired were, I mean, the one before that was the Silk Road piece, which was 22,000 words long, which they ran in two parts. And so it's always great to work with Wired.
I'm waiting for them to do that to me, but they keep cutting mine in half.
Well, it's only 96 pages an issue now. So they have to like...
I know.
Yeah, I still get the half cut. I don't know why, but Josh, it's really been great. And I hope you went home with at least one of those meteorites, because
you know, I did not get a piece of it. The pieces were all gone, but I also, that particular meteorite is not really the handsome kind. That was a chondrite, uh-huh. which is a certain type of rock, and the palachites, which have iron in them, are the ones that are, you can cut them and they look sort of like silver with like crystals in them, and they look very dramatic. And as a token of working on that story, I haven't done this yet, but I was going to buy a piece of a palisade from one of those guys that, you know, the guys in the story also are dealers and collectors. And so I was going to get one from them.
Yeah. I have a little chip of one from South America on my shelf.
Cool.
And when you pick it up, you realize that this is not an ordinary earth rock because it's so heavy.
Oh, interesting.
That's so cool. All right, Josh. Well, this is great talking to you, and good luck with your writing. I'm looking forward to your next article.
Great. Thanks so much.
Or your next movie.
Yeah, me too. Looking forward to both. I got to buckle down and get the next article done and get back to this movie stuff.